Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. This is the August 9th, 2013 edition of The Week magazine. The cover has an animated picture of Governor Rick Perry of Texas in a cowboy outfit, and in the background some voters at the voting booths, and the headline says, "Taking on Texas, the Obama administration's decision to challenge state voter ID laws." And we turn to the main stories and how they were covered. The first story being the battle over voter ID laws. What happened? The Obama administration is challenging the right of Texas to enforce rigorous new voting restrictions in the first stage of a major political struggle between the Democratic White House and the Republican-controlled states. The Justice Department filed a request last week to reinstate its authority over Texas's voting laws, which was removed by the U.S. Supreme Court in June. That ruling, striking down a portion of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, ended a requirement for southern states with a history of racial discrimination to get pre-clearance from the government to change their voting laws. Immediately after the ruling, Texas reinstated a voter ID law and a redistricting plan which had earlier been ruled discriminatory. But the Justice Department is challenging those changes under a remaining provision of the Voter Rights Act, which enables it to block new voter laws if it can prove they reduce minority voting. Texas Governor Rick Perry called the Justice Department's lawsuit an end run around the Supreme Court. Republicans say that tightening up voting regulations, including requiring voters to have photo ID and reducing early voting, will prevent fraud. Democrats contend that the laws are meant to discourage minorities, the poor, and college students from voting, since many lack driver's licenses and find it difficult to travel to the polls. North Carolina Senate approved measures last week requiring government-issued photo ID at the polls, shortening early voting and ending same-day voter registration. With other states expected to enact similar legislation, Attorney General Eric Holder said the Texas lawsuit will not be the last. "We cannot allow the slow unraveling of the progress that so many throughout history have sacrificed so much to achieve," he said. What the editorial said. Holder is right to take on Texas, said Bloomberg.com. "The state's new voting laws have a desperate quality to them, allowing a concealed carry gun permit as ID but not student identification cards, in redistricting the state to water down the growing power of Hispanic voters. There and in other states, the incidence of actual voter fraud hovers near zero." "There's nothing wrong with voter ID laws," said the Washington Times. "Asking a voter for proof of identity is a world away from poll taxes and other Jim Crow era laws, and is intended only to ensure that all ballots are cast lawfully by U.S. citizens." Sadly, Holder wants to keep the back door of the polling station unlocked and dilute the integrity of the ballot. What the columnist said. "A new era of voter suppression has begun," said E.J. Dion Jr. in the Washington Post. "North Carolina's voter law, also passed hastily after the court's edict, reads like a parody of conservative proposals, from ending registration drives in colleges, churches, and schools, to barring the use of photo IDs issued by public assistance agencies." "The Texas laws are just as pernicious," said Eric Lewis in NewYorker.com. "They are very obviously a reaction to the tide of demographics that may turn the Lone Star State purple by 2016. Jim Crow with a smile and a request for ID is still Jim Crow. How is it racially discriminatory to ask for a photo ID? Said Jonathan S. Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Most Americans believe it's a common sense measure to request the same type of ID to vote that is required to cash a check or pass through airport security. Only race-baiting liberals believe it's discriminatory conspiracy. The hysteria over voter suppression is overblown, said Ross Douthat at nytimes.com. Since voter ID laws would only make a difference in whisker-tight elections, data from North Carolina's Secretary of State suggests that its proposed laws would have reduced Obama's share of the vote in 2012 from 48.3% to 48%, hardly enough to swing the state. So why are Republicans picking this fight? Voter ID laws further alienate black and Latino voters and hand Democrats a powerful symbolic issue to mobilize their base, while giving the GOP little, if any, reward. This kind of self-defeating behavior will only make it tougher, not easier, for Republicans to win national elections. Manning's mixed verdict. A military court this week found Army Private First Class Bradley Manning guilty of violating the Espionage Act for handling more than 700,000 secret diplomatic cables and battlefield reports to the website WikiLeaks. But Judge Colonel Denise Land acquitted him on the more serious charge of aiding the enemy, dismissing the government's claim that the former intelligence analyst knew that the material would end up in the hands of al-Qaeda. Open government campaigners hailed that acquittal as a victory against the Obama administration's crackdown on leakers. A conviction for aiding the enemy would have put the 25-year-old private in jail for life without parole. Manning, described by his lawyer as good-intentioned whistleblower who wanted to show the American people the hidden horrors of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, could still face up to 136 years in military prison for espionage and stealing government property. Legal experts said the actual sentence, to be decided in the coming weeks, would likely be much shorter. The court seriously erred in acquitting Manning of aiding the enemy, said John Yoo in NationalReview.com. He had to know that posting anything on the Internet would make it available to al-Qaeda in Iraq, Afghanistan, and worldwide. But he went ahead anyway with the largest leak of classified information in U.S. history, placing the lives of American soldiers, agents, and allies at grave risk. Anyone who believes in journalism and democracy should be grateful for this verdict, said Rem Reeder in USA Today. If Manning had been found guilty of aiding the enemy, then any member of the military who leaked classified information to the press, no matter how important to society, could have been charged with treason. That would have included the brave whistleblower who exposed the torture of detainees at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison. Jailing leakers like Manning won't solve the government's secrecy problem, said Matthew Cooper in NationalJournal.com. The Army private was just one of 1.4 million government employees and contractors with access to top-secret material. Since Manning's leak, the Obama administration has made it harder to download secret data without raising suspicions. But as long as so many people are given access to gold mines of classified data, this won't be the last Bradley Manning. Turn the page now to the controversy of the week. The GOP, shutting down the government to stop Obamacare. The GOP has hated the Affordable Care Act from the moment President Obama proposed it, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. But with most of Obamacare's key provisions soon to take effect, desperate Republicans are testing a new frontier of radicalism in a last-ditch effort to block the law. As of October 1st, the government will be unable to pay its debts unless Congress first votes to raise the federal debt ceiling. And last week, a group of GOP senators joined colleagues in the House in vowing not to raise the debt ceiling unless the president agrees to defund, in effect, repeal the ACA. Even for a party that's been careering ever more deeply into ideological extremism, this threat to wreck the economy and America's credit rating marks a frightening new low. In fact, such hostage-taking by congressional leaders has no precedent in our history, said Norm Ornstein in the National Journal. Obamacare is the law of the land. The bill was passed by both houses of Congress, signed by the president, upheld by the Supreme Court, and effectively reaffirmed by voters in the 2012 election. For the losers of that election to now demand that the ACA be killed anyway or they'll shut down the government is contemptible, a defiant insult to democracy itself. No, it's not, said Stephen Hayes in WeeklyStandard.com. The Senate effort to defund the ACA is being led by freshmen Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio, who, along with dozens of House members, were specifically sent to Washington to derail Obamacare by voters in the 2010 midterms. What those voters knew is that anyone with basic math skills knows that you can't extend health insurance coverage to 30 million more people while at the same time improving the quality of care and lowering costs. They also rightfully object to the creation of a vast new federal bureaucracy that will erode their liberty. If ever there were a time for being aggressive, it's now. As bad as Obamacare is likely to be, threatening to shut down the government will backfire on Republicans, said Ramesh Ponuru in Bloomberg.com. The probability of President Obama surrendering and scrapping his signature legislative achievement approaches 0%, regardless of the threat. If a shutdown actually took place, the public would almost certainly blame Republicans for the ensuing crisis and punish them in 2014 midterm elections. Besides, said Peter Sutterman in Reason.com, no one really believes in defunding threat would work. The defunding threat would work, not party leaders, and not even the authors of the threat. Republicans are just desperate for a cause to rally their factions around, but blocking Obamacare isn't it, since Republicans can offer no real alternative of their own. In fact, no coherent policy on health care at all. But even if we can't block the rollout of Obamacare insurance exchanges in 2014, said William Crystal in the Weekly Standard, we can make a principled stand. If Obamacare is going to be a train wreck for the nation, then surely Republicans have a duty to try to stop the train, regardless of the political cost. Well, there you have it, said John Favreau in thedailybeast.com. Republicans are so frightened that Obama's reform of our broken health care system will prove that government can be an effective force for good, that they'll do anything, including wreck the economy and damage their own already tarnished standing with voters, to stop it. The party of small government is rapidly devolving into the party of no government. And now, on a shorter and somewhat lighter note, we turn to the Good Week 4, Bad Week 4 blurbs. First of all, a Good Week 4, freedom of religion. After the Department of Veterans Affairs authorized U.S. soldiers who identify as Norse neo-pagans to have Thor's hammer etched on their gravestones. A good week for freedom from religion. After Guantanamo Bay officials told a congressional delegation that the erotic novel, 50 Shades of Grey, not the Koran, was the book most requested by the camp's high-value detainees. There's not much going on here. These guys are going nowhere. So what the hell, said Representative Jim Moran. A good week for fishtails. After the Kremlin posted a video purporting to show Russian President Vladimir Putin catching a monster 46-pound pike while vacationing in Siberia. I wonder what is the name of the diver who put it on his hook, said one Russian blogger. And a bad week for doing what you love. After Minnesota tax officials hit transsexual musician Venus DeMars with $3,000 in back taxes by denying her deductions for expenses. Officials said DeMars took too much pleasure from her performances to be considered a professional. Bad week for the Indian military after it spent 6 months investigating what it thought were 155 violations of its airspace by Chinese spy drones or UFOs, only to discover that the mysterious bright objects were, in fact, Jupiter and Venus. And a bad week for pranks, after a practical joker unleashed a noxious combination of deer repellent and fart spray into two cabins at a Bible camp in Maryland. Six campers were hospitalized, and a local hazmat team was summoned to help dissipate the strong odor. Now we take a look at the briefing section. Legal rights for apes. The great apes can think, feel, and communicate. Does that mean they should have the same rights as people? Where did this idea originate? 20 years ago, philosophers Peter Singer and Paola Cavalieri published The Great Ape Project, a book that called for chimpanzees, gorillas, bonobos, and orangutans to be accorded the same basic rights as human beings. Since then, a movement has taken root to urge governments in the United Nations to grant legal rights to chimpanzees and other great apes, banning their captivity in zoos and circuses, and their use in medical testing for disease like AIDS or hepatitis. New Zealand extended personhood rights to great apes in 1999, and Spain followed suit in 2008. The UK, Sweden, Australia, Belgium, and the Netherlands have also banned research on apes for ethical reasons. While stopping short of a ban, the U.S. government announced this year it would limit funding for medical research to 50 chimpanzees. I'm confident that greatly reducing their use in biomedical research is scientifically sound and the right thing to do, said Francis S. Collins, director of the National Institutes of Health. Why give rights to apes? Activists say that it's now clear that our primate cousins have demonstrated that they have inner lives and relationships, can communicate and experience emotions. Therefore, they say, we human beings should expand our moral circle to include the great apes and protect them from the deliberate infliction of suffering. Apes share up to 98.7% of their DNA with humans, notes primatologist Jane Goodall, who says that in a half century of observing chimps, she saw many examples of compassion, altruism, calculation, communication, and even some form of conscious thought. There is no sharp line dividing us from the chimpanzee or from any of the great apes, Goodall says. Why do the advocates believe apes can think? The primary evidence offered is the capacity of great apes to learn and use language. The female gorilla Coco, for instance, can make signs for about 1,000 words and understand around 2,000 spoken English words. Scientists at the Great Ape Trust near Des Moines claim that a pair of bonobos there use language to build sentences, express empathy, and engage in gossip. In the wild, chimps have been observed to use gestures very similar to humans, such as pointing or raising their arms as a way of asking to be picked up. They've also been observed using tools. Do they have feelings? There's little doubt that they do. They show emotions similar to those that we describe in ourselves as happiness, sadness, fear, and despair, Goodall said. Chimpanzees become anxious and upset when they are taken away from their families. Research also shows that apes feel anger and jealousy when other apes are fed more than they are. They seem capable, too, of recognizing feelings in other apes. When a chimp named Pansy was dying in Scotland in 2010, her family groomed and comforted her as she approached her end. After she died, her best friend Blossom sat by her lifeless body through the night. The other chimps in the enclosure refused to sleep where Patsy died for 5 days afterward. What do the skeptics say? They say that being similar to humans doesn't make apes the same as humans, and question whether sympathetic humans like Goodall are anthropomorphizing, projecting human traits on animals. Steve Jones, professor of genetics at the University of London, points out that even mice share 90% of our DNA. Should they get 90% of human rights, he said? Where do you stop? Humans have rights because we live under a moral code, said John D. Morris, an evolutionary creationist. Animals have no understanding of that code. No ape has any awareness of right or wrong, he said. If a loose chimp steals a picnic basket in the park, does he go to jail? The skeptics also say that ending medical research on apes will delay or prevent effective vaccines and treatments and cost human lives. If we are going to consider closing down AIDS and hepatitis research and giving human rights to chimps, said University of Florida animal psychologist Clive Wynn, we had better be certain we are not just giving in to a natural but baseless anthropomorphic tendency without solid evidence to back it up. How solid is the evidence? It's virtually impossible to prove whether apes are conscious, since neuroscientists still can't agree on how to define consciousness or how it arises in the human brain. But advocates for ape rights say the fundamental question is not scientific, but moral. We do know for certain that great apes have complex mental abilities, which elevate their capability for suffering. On that basis alone, say rights advocates, apes deserve basic protections from the pain, isolation, and arbitrary imprisonment inflicted by medical experiments or captivity in zoos. Great apes are thinking, self-aware beings with rich emotional lives, said Peter Singer. If we regard human rights as something possessed by all human beings, no matter how limited their intellectual and emotional capacities may be, how can we deny similar rights to the great apes? When chimps retire. Now that the U.S. is retiring most of the chimpanzees it has used for medical testing, they're finally getting their first taste of freedom. The chimps are being moved to animal sanctuaries, most of them to the federally run Chimp Haven in Shreveport, Louisiana, which houses over 120 chimps in large social groups and 200 acres of parkland. Some of these chimps have never before been outdoors and are transformed. A year later, you're not dealing with the same chimp who came here, said caregiver Diane LaBarbera. Earlier this year, 53-year-old Julius made the move after decades in a barren cage at the New Iberia Research Center, getting his first glimpse of the sky since he was captured in Africa as an infant. The freed chimps seemed confused at first, then euphoric, and behaviorist Amy Fultz, and then seemed confused at first, then euphoric, and behaviorist Amy Fultz said, behaviorist Amy Fultz, they light up. They look at the sky. To me, they seem to be thinking, there's no bars. And now the best columns of the U.S. The first, when blacks aren't judged as individuals. by Connor Friedersdorf of TheAtlantic.com. Should white people racially profile young black men? In the wake of the Trayvon Martin trial, said Connor Friedersdorf, several conservative commentators, most notably Victor Davis Hanson of National Review, have said it's perfectly rational for white people to view black men with fear and heightened suspicion, since blacks as a group commit more violent crimes per capita than whites. But at the heart of this argument is a glaring contradiction. Hanson, like other conservatives, is adamantly opposed to affirmative action, supposedly because classifying people by race or ethnicity is anti-American. In college admissions and hiring, he maintains, colorblindness should be our guiding ideal. But when you see an African-American male on the street, Hanson says, it's permissible, and indeed prudent, to judge him not as an individual, but by his skin color, even though the vast majority of young black men never commit crimes. So when blacks receive special treatment that benefits them, it's a terrible injustice. But when blacks are treated as a suspect class, and they're frisked, followed, or shot, that's fine. What happened to color blindness? The second column, written by Stephen L. Carter, Bloomberg.com, is titled Bursting the President's Bubble. President Obama lives in a bubble, said Stephen L. Carter, and it's high time we burst it. Isolated from the public, our chief executives spend too much time surrounded by fawning staffers and carefully vetted crowds, and too little time meeting ordinary people. Perhaps it's time to revive a tradition practiced by presidents from the early days of our republic up to Herbert Hoover, the levee. Once a year, on January 1st, the president would open up the White House to the American people, greeting and talking to as many people who waited in line. Abraham Lincoln called these receptions my public opinion baths, and while conceding they weren't always pleasant, said that they were renovating and invigorating to my perceptions. In 1864, four black Americans came to the levee to meet Lincoln, a momentous assertion of their right to citizenship. Unfortunately, the tradition came to an end when Hoover, exhausted from all that handshaking, decided to spend New Year's Day in Florida instead. Next January 1st marks the 150th anniversary of the day Lincoln showed that the White House was truly open to all comers. What better time to renew a great American tradition? In the final column, Let's Abolish Summer Vacation, comes to us from Matthew Iglesias at Slate.com. There are few more cherished American traditions than the summer vacation, said Matthew Iglesias. Many of us have nostalgic memories of long days chasing fireflies, selling lemonade, and going to sleepaway camp. But for underprivileged Americans and their kids, summer vacation is a disaster. Research has shown that the average student loses about a month of schooling over the summer break. But poorer students lose far more than wealthier kids. In fact, they fall further behind each and every summer. While wealthier parents spend thousands of dollars to send their kids off to enriching experiences at camp or on trips, working class single moms are put in a nearly impossible situation, having to somehow watch and occupy their kids while holding down a job. Schools are a public service, and no other public service just vanishes for months at a time. Imagine the reaction if police, air traffic controllers, or bus drivers vacationed en masse. Education is just as important to society as law and order, and allowing schools to close their doors every summer critically undermines their purpose and widens the class gulf between rich and poor. School should happen all year round. Flipping to the back of the magazine, we'll take a look now at the last word. Living 30 seconds at a time. After Henry lost the ability to form memories, says Suzanne Corkin, scientists flocked to study his brain. Henry Mollison and I sat opposite each other, a microphone on the narrow table between us. I understand that you have a little trouble remembering things, I said. Yes, I do. I do have, well, a lot of trouble remembering things, you know. How long have you had trouble remembering things? That? I don't know myself. I can't tell you because I don't remember. Well, do you think it's days or weeks, months, years? Well, see, I can't put it in exactly on a day, week, or month, or year basis. But do you think it's been more than a year that you've had this problem? I think it's about that, 1 year or more, because I believe I had, and this is just a thought that I'm having myself, that, well, I possibly have had an operation or something. Our conversation took place in May 1992, nearly 40 years after Henry's capacity to form long-term memories disappeared as a result of a risky surgical intervention. In 1953, when he was 27, he underwent a bilateral medial temporal lobe resection, an experimental brain operation intended to alleviate the severe epilepsy that he had faced since childhood. The operation did control his seizures, but with an unanticipated and devastating consequence, an extreme amnesia that robbed Henry of the ability to form new memories and, in doing so, determine the course of the rest of his life. From the beginning, one of the most striking aspects of Henry's memory loss was how remarkably specific it was. He forgot all of his experiences after his operation, but retained much of what he had learned before that. He knew his parents and other relatives, recalled historical facts he had learned in school, had a good vocabulary, and could perform routine daily tasks, such as brushing his teeth, shaving, and eating. One important lesson scientists have learned from people with selective memory loss, such as Henry's, is that memory is not a single process, but a collection of many different processes. Henry's case shed light on a long-standing controversy about whether brief memory mechanisms are distinct from lasting ones. The basic question was whether the processes that support short-term memory, which holds a limited amount of information temporarily, differ from those that support long-term memory, which hangs on to vast amounts of information for minutes, days, months, or years. Short-term memory, as defined by memory researchers, does not refer to recalling what we did yesterday, this morning, or even 20 minutes ago. That sort of recollection is recent, long-term memory. Short-term memory is the immediate present, the information on our radar screens at this very moment. It expires within about 30 seconds, depending on the task. Its capacity is limited, and it fades immediately if we do not rehearse it or convert it into a form that can be retained in long-term memory. When I tell a friend my phone number, the digits will remain in her short-term store briefly, and she will quickly forget them unless she mentally processes them or writes them down. Long-term memory is anything we remember after just seconds have elapsed. Was the formation of short and long-term memory part of a single process, or instead governed by wholly separate processes? Those who supported the dual process theory sought evidence that a particular patient was impaired on test of long-term but not short-term memory, and that another patient was impaired on short-term memory tasks, but not long-term. These two results, taken together, would indicate that the two kinds of memory were independent. Henry played a starring part in this research. If the single process theory were correct, then Henry's short-term memory should have been compromised. As it was, his short-term memory remained intact, while his long-term memory disappeared, suggesting that not only were they separate processes, but they also depended on different areas of the brain. Psychologist Brenda Milner saw that Henry could provide experimental evidence to address the single process versus dual process debate. In 1962, Milner's graduate student, Lily Prisco, gathered data on his short-term memory. She asked Henry to compare two simple nonverbal stimuli that were separated by a brief delay. The challenge for him was to hold the first item in his memory long enough to say whether it was the same or different from the second item. Prisco chose several kinds of test items, enabling her to collect data from Henry in multiple experiments. Some used sounds such as clicks and tones, and others used visual images such as light flashes, colors, and non-geometric nonsense figures. In the first experiment, the stimulus was a series of flashes from a strobe light at a rate of 3 per second. After a brief delay, another set of flashes appeared, moving faster now at about 8 per second. Henry had to say different to indicate that there had been a change between the two stimuli. On other trials, the flashes appeared at the same rate, and he had to say same. The results of this experiment provided an important basis for understanding Henry's capacity for perceiving and retaining information. He could easily and accurately perform the task when there was no delay between stimuli, making only one error in 12 trials. He clearly had no problem with the instructions or perceiving the test stimuli. Prisco next tested Henry with the same sets of flashes, this time separated by 15, 30, or 60 seconds. The ability to differentiate between stimuli becomes harder for everyone as the gap between them gets longer and as short-term memory weakens. In Henry's case, however, the differential was extreme. With a 15-second interval, Henry still performed well, making 2 errors out of 12 trials. When the delay was 30 seconds, his errors increased to 4. At 60 seconds, his answers were wrong on 6 of the 12 trials, no better than if he had flipped a coin each time to choose his answer. In comparison, normal control subjects made an average of 1 error out of 12 during the 60-second delay between stimuli. The abrupt breakdown in Henry's performance showed that his short-term memory lasted less than 60 seconds. Somewhere between 30 and 60 seconds, his memory of what he had seen or heard crept away. Because Henry could rely on short-term memory, he harnessed cognitive control processes to compensate. By mentally rehearsing information he was asked to remember, he could sometimes keep thoughts fresh in his mind until asked to retrieve them. Milner noticed this ability during her first testing session with Henry in 1955. She gave Henry these instructions. "I want you to remember the number 584. Then she left the office. 20 minutes later, she returned and asked Henry, "What were the numbers?" 584, he replied. "Oh, that's very good," she said. "How did you do that?" "Well, 5, 8, and 4 add up to 17, Henry answered. "Divide by 2, you have 9 and 8. Remember 8, then 5. You're left with 5 and 4. 5, 8, 4. It's simple." "Well, that's very good. And do you remember my name?" "No, I'm sorry. My trouble is my memory. I'm Dr. Milner, and I come from Montreal." "Oh, Montreal, Canada," Henry said. "I was in Canada once. I went to Toronto." "Oh, do you still remember the number? Number? Was there a number?" The complex calculations Henry had devised to keep the number in his head were gone. As soon as his attention was diverted to another topic, the content was lost. Our understanding of short-term memory has become more complex as we study how we use our memories in everyday life. As we take in information from the world, we engage numerous complex processes in the brain. If someone tries to multiply 68 by 73 in her head, she is performing calculations, saving the results, combining numbers, and checking their accuracy. The task requires much more effort than just regurgitating items held in her short-term memory. It is mental labor. This sort of process is called working memory, an effortful extension of short-term memory, a mental workspace where cognitive operations take place. Current models of working memory emphasize the interactions between short-term and long-term memory. Cognitive neuroscientists have championed the view that working memory integrates specific information from different time periods, the sight, sound, smells, taste, and skin, and body sensations that just entered the brain, and the contents of long-term memory that are relevant to these inputs. Imagine a woman in a restaurant who is listening to a waiter list the day's specials. She keeps the list of dishes active in her working memory while simultaneously evaluating each dish, based on knowledge stored in her long-term memory. After shuffling these options in her head, she decides not swordfish because of its mercury content, not fried chicken because it has too much fat, but the vegetarian pasta sounds similar to a dish I liked before. She orders the pasta. Although she made this decision quickly, it came about through cooperation across networks of brain areas, enabling her to monitor and manipulate different kinds of information. Henry's working memory was sufficiently robust to allow him to play bingo, speak in sentences, and do simple arithmetic in his head. He was unable, however, to integrate his online thoughts with memories of the recent past. If he ordered a meal in a restaurant, he could make a choice based on what he liked and disliked before his operation, but he could not take into account what he had eaten the day before, whether he had to select low-calorie items to control his weight, or if he needed to limit his salt intake. Henry depended on his caregivers to fill in that information and much more. His daily life had many limitations because he lacked vital long-term memory capacities. No one would doubt that Henry's experience was a tragedy, but he rarely seemed to suffer and was not continuously lost and frightened. Quite the contrary, he always lived in the moment, fully accepting the events of daily life. From the time of his operation, every new person he met was forever a stranger. Yet he approached each one with openness and trust. Henry was free from the moorings that kept us anchored in time, attachments that can sometimes be burdensome. Our long-term memory is critical to our survival, but it also hinders us. It prevents us from escaping embarrassing moments we have lived through, the pain we feel when thinking about lost loved ones and our failures, traumas, and problems. When we consider how much of the anxiety and pain of daily life stems from attending to our long-term memories and worrying about and planning for the future, we can appreciate why Henry lived much of his life with relatively little stress. He was unencumbered by recollections from the past and speculations about the future. As frightening as it seems to live without a long-term memory, a part of us all can understand how liberating it might be to always experience life as it is right now, in the simplicity of a world bounded by 30 seconds. This article was excerpted with permissions from Permanent Present Tense by Suzanne Corkin. Moving to the health and science section, the world's biggest virus. A huge virus discovered in sediment on the Chilean coast and another in an Australian pond are not only the largest scientists have ever seen, but also among the most baffling. A single so-called Pandora virus is 1,000 times the size of the influenza virus and holds 2,556 genes, compared with the flu's 13. Only 6% of its genes resemble those found in other organisms, leading some scientists to conclude that it may represent an entirely unknown form of life. The virus may have emerged from a new ancestral cellular type that no longer exists, study author Jean-Michel Claveri of AIX Marseille University in France tells NPR.org. It could even have originated on another planet. At this point, we cannot actually disprove or disregard this type of extreme scenario, Claveri says. Most viruses are tiny in order to infect larger cells and use them to manufacture more viruses. Experts say that the Pandora viruses appear to pose no threat to humans. But again, Claveri says, never say never. Dementia's earliest signs. Healthy people who are concerned about subtle lapses in their memory, like forgetting the plot of TV shows or getting lost in familiar places, may be picking up on early signs of dementia that their family members, friends, and doctors can't yet detect. In one recent study, researchers found that people who were concerned about their memory were 56% more likely to be diagnosed with early-stage dementia than those who weren't. And even among subjects who aced cognitive tests, the more memory trouble they reported having, the more beta amyloid, a protein linked to Alzheimer's, was visible when researchers scanned their brains. Years before a clinical diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, the individual may be the best judge that his or her memory isn't what it used to be, Rebecca Amariglio, a neurologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital, tells NBCNews.com. Being able to identify Alzheimer's symptoms early could allow researchers to test treatments to halt the disease progression. Most senior moments, however, are nothing to worry about. Every time you forget someone's name, said Risa Sperling, director of the Alzheimer's Center at Brigham, you don't need to go running to the doctor. Symptoms that do appear worrisome include getting easily confused or becoming disoriented in familiar places. Health scare of the week. The peril of skipping breakfast. Nearly 1 in 5 adults in the U.S. say they frequently miss breakfast, and new research suggests that they may be endangering their hearts. Harvard School of Public Health researchers interviewed nearly 27,000 middle-aged and older men about their eating habits, and then tracked their health for 16 years. They found, though, that those who regularly skipped breakfast were nearly 30% more likely to have a heart attack or to die from heart disease in that period than those who didn't, regardless of whether they exercised, smoked, or overate. Researchers say skipping breakfast may stress the body in ways that would raise blood pressure and the likelihood of diabetes. They say eating erratically can throw circadian rhythms out of whack, making our bodies less efficient at processing food and increasing the risk of obesity and heart disease. Previous research has shown that people who eat late at night have a 55% higher risk of heart disease. Eat in the morning when you wake up, preferably within an hour, said author Leah Cahill, tells BBCNews.com. Something is better than nothing, but it's always better to have something healthy and balanced. Gold's cosmic origins. All the gold on Earth was forged in the collisions of massively dense stars billions of years ago. Astronomers have come to this conclusion after observing and analyzing the afterglow of a crash between two neutron stars in a galaxy 3.9 billion light-years away that yielded a hoard of gold likely equal to the mass of 20 Earths. At today's prices, that amount of gold would be worth $10 octillion, Harvard professor of astronomy Ido Berger tells USA Today. After the Big Bang, the universe contained only hydrogen, helium, and lithium. Later, elements like carbon and oxygen were spewed out of exploding stars called supernovas. But supernovas never appeared to have enough energy to produce heavier elements like gold, platinum, and lead. Now, researchers think smash-ups of neutron stars, the collapsed cores of giant stars, create those metals, which likely traveled to Earth billions of years ago on meteors. The gold and jewelry that people are wearing is the result of one of the most violent explosions in the universe, says astrophysicist Stephen Rosswag of Jacobs University in Germany. Unfortunately, the collisions, which University of California, Berkeley astrophysicist Daniel Kaysen suggests calling bling novas, only happen in our galaxy every 100,000 years. And finally, we go to the talking points with an article on online education, the coming revolution. A revolution in higher education is coming, said Danielle Allen in WashingtonPost.com. And it's all because of MOOCs. It sounds like mob slang, but a MOOC, or a massive open online course, is actually a series of lectures streamed to tens of thousands of students across the country, instead of just to those in a classroom. By using such lectures as the basis for the new menu of educational options, ranging from degree programs mixing traditional and virtual classes, to purely online vocational training in, say, film or engineering, universities could tailor programs to individual students, offer access to the best professors in any field, and cut cost and tuition significantly. San Jose State University, for instance, offers an online course for $150, rather than the usual $2,000 class fee. Last week, President Obama jumped on the MOOC bandwagon, expressing support for blending teaching with online learning. How do you teach tens of thousands of people anything at once? Asked Jonathan Rees in Slate.com. Answer, you don't. A lecturer can deliver information and transmit facts online, but that's not an education. If I taught history through a series of rote lectures, I'd be in another line of work right now. Educating people requires teaching them what to do with these facts, and providing them with skills to get new information themselves, something only face-to-face interaction can provide. Colleges are intrigued by MOOCs simply because they would enable them to fire a lot of teachers and drastically cut labor costs. Critics of online education are dismissed as Luddites, said Sarah Kendzior in AlJazeera.com. But these courses replicate the two worst aspects of large universities: enormous class sizes and a lack of mentoring and feedback. No wonder they have an average dropout rate of 90%. Academics will fight progress with every fiber of their being, says Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. It would be sad if some lost their jobs, but it would be sadder still to insist that everyone who wants a college degree pay from $80,000 to $250,000 to get one. Our higher education system can't be based on maintaining living standards for college professors. In an economy where a college degree is a prerequisite for middle-class life, ignoring the online revolution will either doom poorer students to crushing college debt or lock them out of upward mobility altogether. Let's give MOOCs a chance. And a few short notes here. Miami has the worst drivers in the U.S., ranking first in automotive fatalities, pedestrian strikes, and road rage incidents, according to an analysis of national statistics. Three of the top five worst cities for drivers are in Florida. This comes from Slate.com. There were 1.57 million prisoners in state and federal jails in 2012, a 1.7% drop from 2011. It was the third consecutive year the prison population has fallen, a trend experts attribute mostly to cash-strapped states cutting their prison costs. That from the WashingtonPost.com. Oil production in North Dakota's Bakken oil fields are flaring or burning off into the air. About a third of the natural gas they drill. A waste of $100 million worth of gas every month. The state lacks sufficient pipelines and processing to service its booming numbers of fracking wells. That from Reuters.com. This from the Wall Street Journal. The birth of Prince George, Britain's newest heir to the throne, was featured on 305 newspaper front pages worldwide. Barack Obama's second inauguration made only 131 front pages. From foreignpolicy.com, the U.S. government has spent more than $24 million over the past 6 years flying a plane over Cuba that beams American-sponsored TV programming that Havana blocks with signal jamming. Congressmen representing Cuban exile communities in Florida have insisted that the blocked telecast continue. Did you know that 67% of Americans believe the war in Afghanistan has not been worth fighting? Yet 53% of Americans say they still want the U.S. to maintain some military presence. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long, until next time.